Welcome to Scarlet Tavern. Grab a drink, take a seat, and let's begin. Nestled in the heart of the Rocky Mountains, where the air is crisp and the scenery serene, there's a hotel that's known for more than just its luxurious rooms and stunning views. Welcome to the Stanley Hotel, where you can check in anytime you'd like, but you might just end up sharing your stay with more than a few lingering guests from the past. If walls could talk, these would probably tell some hair-raising stories, or maybe they'll whisper them to you while you sleep. This is Scarlet Tavern. All right, we're going to do some hauntings. So now that we're...
I'm not scared at all.
Now that we're in October, we're doing some haunting stuff. So this is going to be... two different things. We're starting with the Stanley Hotel, and then we'll transition into the RMS Queen Mary. So, because if we just did one of them, it'd be a short episode, and we don't want to stimp you guys on episodes. So, basically, the Stanley Hotel, nestled in Estes Park, Colorado, is a historic and picturesque mountain resort, best known for its striking architecture, stunning views of the Rocky Mountains, and its eerie reputation as one of America's most haunted hotels. Opened in 1909 by Freeland Oscar Stanley, the hotel was intended to be a luxurious retreat for wealthy guests, offering modern amenities and a breathtaking setting. However, the Stanley Hotel gained worldwide fame after it served as the inspiration for Stephen King's novel, The Shining, a legacy that has cemented its status as a magnet for paranormal enthusiasts and curious tourists alike.
Great movie.
Very good movie. I'm not typically a Stephen King fan. I think Stephen King's too wordy for me.
He's too graphic and too...
I don't care.
I'm a little bitch when it comes to scary movies. I do not like anything that's horror, gore, thriller, nothing. So I tried to read Stephen King's book, The Dome.
Remarkably, one of his less scary books.
You know what,
and I nearly threw up because of how graphic
he was. You know what Pam should read? Pet Cemetery.
No, God, no. Fuck you, no.
I actually think that's his worst book.
You know,
I don't like Pet Cemetery.
His early stuff was very hit and miss. Like, Carrie was a great book. That's what got him famous and everything. I tried reading it, but like you said, it's very wordy. It's very like, oh my God.
It's too much.
But his time traveling book he did about going back and trying to prevent Kennedy from getting assassinated, it was actually really good.
But the hotel's haunted reputation is fueled by numerous reports of ghostly encounters and unexplained phenomena experienced by guests and staff over the years. The most famous of these is the apparition of Freeland Stanley himself, who is said to appear frequently in the hotel's lobby and bar, keeping a watchful eye over his establishment, even in the afterlife. His wife, Flora Stanley, has also been reported, often heard playing the piano in the music room despite no one being present. The fourth floor, particularly room 401, is notorious for paranormal activity where guests have reported hearing children running and laughing in the halls, doors opening and closing on their own, and objects moving inexplicably. Room 217, the room where Stephen King stayed and had his infamous ghostly encounter, is also considered one of the most haunted, with the reports of a spectral maid apparitions and items being mysteriously rearranged. The Stanley Hotel's haunted allure has been explored in numerous paranormal investigations, television shows, and documentaries, cementing its reputation as one of the most haunted hotels in the United States. Whether drawn by the hotel's historical charm, its connection to The Shining, or its active paranormal scene, visitors flock to the Stanley in search of a brush with the supernatural. The blend of luxurious history and spectral lore creates a unique atmosphere that continues to fascinate and unnerve those who walk its halls, making the Stanley Hotel a captivating destination for ghost hunters and history buffs alike. I'll tell you right now, if we had the time... we would have gone to the Stanley Hotel and done this in the Stanley Hotel.
Nope.
Love to.
I'm good.
Honey, you would love that hotel.
It's gorgeous.
I understand. It's gorgeous. But no, I'm not going anywhere that's haunted or supposedly haunted.
You've already been somewhere that's haunted.
Yeah. And look at what happened.
We're going back.
Yes.
You two are going back. I'm going to stay safe at home.
Honestly.
That's the Ohio State Reformatory.
Great place to visit, by the way.
Yes.
You can
do normal day tours, which is what we did, so it really wasn't haunted. And then you can do ghost tours up there. So.
I'm not saying I saw shit. I just was feeling shit that I didn't like feeling.
Listen,
I got scared. That was mostly because of that damn.
Listen, we went in there and there was a room with a single chair in the middle of it.
Yeah, that was.
And cute. I went and sat in the fucking chair.
That was dumb.
I went and sat in the chair.
I told you it was dumb before you did it. I told you it was dumb while you did it. And I told you it was dumb after you did it.
Ben, who's terrified of heights, just didn't like the catwalks.
And you see that thing?
Was fucking scary. That was a little nerve-wracking.
Sketchy as hell.
Especially when everybody was moving at the same time. You just felt it moving and rocking and shit.
What's supposed to happen?
So, in 1903, Freeland Oscar Stanley, the co-inventor of the steam-powered Stanley Steamer automobile.
Also the vacuum, too.
Yes, this now. Is, yeah, Stanley Steamer gets carpet cleaner.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
same guy. Faced a life-threatening resurgence of tuberculosis, a common and often fatal disease at the time. The recommended treatment involved plenty of fresh air, sunlight, and a hearty diet, prompting many patients known as lungers to seek therapeutic climate of the Rocky Mountains. Following this advice, Stanley and his wife Flora traveled to Denver, Colorado in March of that year. By June, on the recommendation of Dr. Sherman Grant Bonney, they moved to Estes Park for the remainder of the summer. The high altitude air and serene environment had a remarkable impact on Stanley's health, leading to a dramatic recovery. Deeply impressed by the natural beauty of Estes Park and grateful for his improved health, Stanley decided to return every summer. He lived to the age of 91, passing away from a heart attack in Newton, Massachusetts in 1940, just 1 year after Flora's death. So here's the thing. So tuberculosis in the early 1900s, late 1800s, it was a death sentence.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There was no cure for it. 9 times out of 10, you were dying. What? If anybody's seen the movie Moulin Rouge, the musical, what Nicole Kidman has in that, she's coughing up blood. She has tuberculosis. That's what she has. It's very common back then.
That's why if any fellow fans of the Western genre of movies or books like I am.
I think you're like the only one, babe.
There are others. I hope.
All two of you.
If you ever notice in a lot of the books and the movies, there's always that guy who's the lunger, he's got the tuberculosis. Well, Out west was the cure because the dry, arid air of the Southwest particularly was thought, in many cases, proven true to be at least help alleviate the symptoms. In this case, you know, with Freeland Stanley actually just completely wiped it out.
I mean, if we look at the...
Well, not wipe it out.
Oh, no. It wiped it out. He was cured.
He was cured.
He was completely cured.
TB is, like, usually not curable.
He was completely cured.
That's weird.
Welcome to nature.
Yeah.
One of the best, actually, probably the best movie ever created, Tombstone.
Stone. Great movie. Loved
Doc
it.
Doc Holliday has...
Val Kilmer.
Val Kilmer was Doc Holliday. Doc Holliday died of tuberculosis.
He, among
other things.
Yeah. His case was also more advanced. By the time he sought medical treatment from all of his gambling, whoring, and other outlaw stuff, it was done for. The only reason they sent him out west was probably because there was more chances for him to steal and cheat at cards.
Well,
and it was just, it would alleviate his symptoms, but he was done.
Then tuberculosis, which is typically a lung disease.
Yeah.
He was also a heavy smoker. So it really amplified it, but Tombstone, greatest movie ever made.
We should watch it after.
We need to. It's so good.
I'm good.
Nope.
I'm good.
No.
All right.
We're watching Warehouse 13, I thought.
So by 1907, Stanley had fully recovered, but he was dissatisfied with rustic accommodations and relaxed lifestyle of Estes Park, which did not match the refined taste of a social circle from the East Coast. Determined to transform Estes Park into a more sophisticated resort destination, Stanley embarked on an ambitious project to develop the area. In 1907, he began construction on the Stanley Hotel, a luxurious 48-room establishment designed to cater to affluent urbanites and health seekers alike. His vision was to create a grand hotel that would provide the same level of comfort and elegance found in the most prestigious hotels at the time.
Now, you know, it's interesting. These days, we would probably hate Stanley for doing this because, yeah, like, oh, you're gentrifying the area. You're ruining the setting. You know, you out-of-towners. Back then, they used to love it when people would do, yeah, stuff.
The hotel was completed in 1909 and quickly became a symbol of luxury and modernity. That's such a of modern times.
Yeah.
That's such a weird word.
I thought it was sounding
modernity.
Modernity. Yeah, there maybe. We go.
Featuring amenities such as electric lighting, telephones, and a fleet of Stanley steamer automobiles to transport guests. Stanley's investments in Estes Park significantly boosted the local economy and transformed the area into a popular summer retreat for the wealthy.
Still is.
The main Stanley Hotel and its concert hall were completed Stanley Hotel and its concert hall were completed in 1909, with the manor following in 1910. To accommodate guests traveling from the nearest train depot in Lyons, Colorado, Stanley's car company developed a fleet of custom steam-powered vehicles known as mountain wagons, capable of seating multiple passengers. These vehicles were specially designed to navigate the rugged terrain between Lyons and Estes Park. Which, if you've ever been there, it is rugged. I was stationed in Wyoming, so I was in Colorado a lot. And I've been to Estes Park a few times. Never got to go to Stanley. I was supposed to attend a wedding at the Stanley, and I ended up moving before the wedding happened. But although the hotel operated more as a personal passion for Stanley rather than a profitable venture, he often remarked that he spent more money than he earned each summer.
This is literally at this point, and I'm sure even to a little bit today, it's still a remote part of Colorado. So
yeah,
probably trying to get electricity and all that modern amenities were probably really hard on that place.
In 1926, Stanley sold the hotel to a private company that was formed solely to manage the property, but the business failed, leading Stanley to repurchase the hotel from foreclosure in 1929. He sold it again in 1930 to Roe Emery, a fellow entrepreneur in the automobile and hospitality industries from Denver. Stanley Hotel operated as a seasonal resort until 1983, closing during the winter months each year. Stanley's involvement in Estes Park and the hotel's presence significantly contributed to the town's growth and the establishment of Rocky Mountain National Park in 1915. The hotel was formerly a member of Historic Hotels of America, a program under the National Trust for Historic Preservation, although it is no longer part of the program as of 2022.
I could never find out why they did that. I mean, it is very unique. It's a very unique place. I can't imagine why they would not want to preserve it. I mean, being a part of that Historic Hotels of America almost guarantees you that the place would not be torn down or can't be torn down.
Let's see. Let me see something.
So shortly after opening, Stanley Hotel was advertised as one of the few establishments in the world powered entirely by electricity. Back then, that was very big. Tesla and Edison were still kind of going at it. However, due to insufficient power supply, an auxiliary gas lighting system was installed in June of 1911. On June 25th, the day after the gas pipes were fitted, an explosion occurred, injuring a maid and causing structural damage to the hotel.
He cannot speak. He messes up on words all the time.
Okay, I found out why it was removed. So, it was removed due to changes in the hotel's focus and ownership that did not align with the program's criteria. The program emphasizes a store goal integrity, including architectural preservation and maintaining a strong connection to the property's historical significance. In the case of the Stanley Hotel, while it remains a notable historic property, the shift towards more modern renovations, luxury accommodations, and a focus on tourism, driven by its association with pop culture, may have caused a divergence from the preservation-oriented goals required by the National Trust. Yeah, that's why. Because they started to modernize instead of just trying to keep it as it was. Because of that, it removes them. So, reports on the incident varied. An Associated Press article relayed to the York Dispatch stated that the explosion partially wrecked the hotel, injuring 8 people, including a maid named Elizabeth Wilson from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, who reportedly fell from the 2nd floor to the 1st, breaking both ankles. She's from Lancaster. Nobody cares about her.
Wow.
Damn.
I know people that live in Lancaster.
Oh. Okay.
That area is where my family's from.
Oh.
That's like northeastern Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
However, discrepancies arose as local Colorado newspapers identified the maid as Elizabeth Lampert, and various dramatic details were reported that were not consistent across sources. Most detailed account appearing in the Fort Collins Express on June 29th contradicted the claim that the maid had been hurled between floors, suggesting that the incident, while serious, was not as catastrophic as initially reported.
I read of another incident where she was in a coma for about several months, but then she woke up, and there's a lot of things. I think gas explosion, she got rolled back. Luckily, she survived. That's kind of the gist of it.
She may have broken a bone, but yeah. Just by getting hurled back, but
I would have demanded a raise if that were me.
Haunted Room 217.
Now we're getting to the hauntings of the hotel.
The Stanley Hotel, renowned for its eerie atmosphere and historical significance, has one room in particular that stands out for its haunted reputation, Room 217. This room gained widespread fame in the 1970s when author Stephen King, already living in Boulder, Colorado, while working on his novel The Stand, decided to take a weekend trip with his wife Tabitha to Estes Park. Seeking a brief escape from their daily life, the couple arrived at the Stanley Hotel, which was about to close for the season. In a recent interview on The View, and I'm saying recent, like years ago, because when we research the articles that were research of this are older.
Yeah.
Because Stephen King doesn't really do anything anymore.
He's kind of, he still writes, but
he's more of a recluse now.
Yeah.
You don't see him show up at premieres. Like, he used to go to like the old It premiere and stuff like that. He didn't do that with this new one.
He actually worked with a friend of mine I worked with in Massachusetts. He actually went to college in the town where Stephen King and his wife live, and he used to be, before his accident, he used to be very sociable, like you said, going out to premieres. He used to invite the local college kids actually and have Thanksgiving dinner for them.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
But
puts a lot of money back into the community, all of that stuff.
But one night Stephen King was actually walking on the road to his house from somewhere where he got sideswiped by a car and he got sent flying into a ditch. Yeah, they think
it was a drunk driver.
Most likely, especially in that area.
I believe it was a hit and run.
It was. I don't know if they
ever caught the guy.
He almost died. I mean, like, he got flung into a ditch. Luckily, somebody was following not that far behind, so they witnessed it and they were able to get to him, because they said if they hadn't,
he'd be dead.
He would have been dead.
So I believe it was during winter months, so he would have froze to death.
Yeah.
So after that, he kind of became very reclusive. He just stayed around his family because he almost died. So.
Yeah.
I believe he has a few kids, too.
Oh, yeah. One of them's a writer. Two. At least one's a writer.
Because he's 77.
Oh,
now.
Yeah, he's up there. Yeah, he still writes and stuff, but he does, and he still writes reviews.
Yeah, he has 3 kids. Yeah, Joe Hill, Naomi King, and Owen King. I believe Joe Hill's the writer.
Yes.
Yeah,
his wife also writes, too. I've never really read any of her stuff.
Actually, Joe Hill and Stephen King wrote a book together called In the Tall Grass. He's the one that created Lock and Key.
Oh,
the comic series that turned into the Netflix show, that's Joe Hill. great. We'll have to watch it. It's a very good show.
The Stain.
I think that's on our list of stuff that to watch that I haven't watched.
It was written by Joe Hill.
The Stain is also really good. I tried getting through it. Mr. King, if you listen to me, I tried getting through it. It's just,
I promise he doesn't listen to us.
He doesn't.
But still, cut down your...
Stop being so wordy.
Seriously.
So he explained that when they arrived, the hotel was on its last day of operation for the season, with all of the guests having already left. They were the only guests in the vast, empty hotel that night, a situation that heightened the hotel's already spooky ambiance. As they settled into room 217, the wind howled outside, adding to the unsettling atmosphere. That night, King had a vivid and terrifying nightmare, which a fire hose coiled like a snake came to life and chased his young son down the hotel's dark, endless corridors. Waking in a panic, King got up, lit a cigarette, and stared out the window, trying to calm his nerves. By the time he finished his cigarette and returned to bed, the basic outline of what would become The Shining had already formed in his mind.
I can already tell what scene he's thinking about, too, from that movie.
While King's terrifying night in room 217 is the most famous paranormal event associated with the Stanley Hotel, stories of strange occurrences in the hotel, particularly in room 217, date back much earlier. Over the years, guests and staff have reported a variety of unexplained phenomena in the room, including items moving on their own, lights flickering, and even ghostly apparitions. These reports have solidified room 217's status as one of the most haunted rooms in the Stanley Hotel, attracting curious visitors and ghost hunters eager to experience its eerie legacy firsthand.
I think the ghost hunters, you remember the ghost hunters, those guys from Taps, went to the Stanley Hotel. Actually, I like them. They're not bad. It's Zach Baggins, guys. I don't
fuck Zach Baggins. He has a new show coming out.
God,
fuck Zach Baggins.
No. What show now?
I don't know. It's another show he's going to fake.
No, with Taps, it's like Jason Hawes and stuff. Those guys are actually, I feel they're a lot more legitimate. They at least go into a situation like, okay, we're not entirely sure this is haunted. We're going to try and just prove it's haunting.
Zach Baggins, if you listen to this, you're a piece of shit. And you need to quit.
Stop associating yourself with fake exorcists.
Stop faking everything.
Ghost Adventures.
I hope your wife fakes it as much as you do.
Wow.
Good God. I was going to say, like, season 1 and 2 of Ghost Adventures was your best seasons. You didn't fake shit.
Yeah,
until he realized how much money he would get.
Yeah.
So, the Stanley Hotel in Estes Park, Colorado is renowned not just for its scenic location and historical significance, but again, also for its deeply haunted reputation. Although Freeland Oscar Stanley passed away in 1940 at the age of 91, many believe his spirit still lingers within the hotel, particularly in the bar and billiard room where he often spent his time. The spectral presence of his wife Flora is also frequently reported, with guests and staff claiming to hear her playing the piano as if the music of the past continues to echo through the halls. The hotel is said to be haunted by other spirits as well. Some tour guides believe that a ghost of a child with autism roams the property, occasionally playing with guest hair. The fourth floor, in particular, is a hotbed of paranormal activity. Guests have often reported hearing the laughter of children echoing in the hallways, only to find no one around. In a 2021 interview, Rachel Thomas, a tour supervisor at the hotel, recounted a mysterious illness that befell her while on the fourth floor, adding to the floor's creepy reputation. These spine-chilling experiences have helped the Stanley gain international fame as a hotspot for hauntings, leading to features on popular ghost-themed television shows like Ghost Adventures and Ghost Hunters.
I forgot they did do a thing in
I think Stanley everybody goes
very early.
No, everybody goes to Ghost Hunters.
The Tennessee Wraith Chasers who do Ghost Asylum and Haunted Towns Neverland.
Yeah.
The hotel's eerie allure extends beyond its guest rooms. The property includes an on-site pet cemetery where several of the owner's animals have been laid to rest over the years. And rumor is that that's where
Pet Cemetery also
is where he got the idea for Pet Cemetery.
I'm just, when I looked at that when I was researching and writing, I was like, oh yeah, now I see where that came from.
Among the ghostly pets, Cassie, a golden retriever, is said to still deliver newspapers and scratch at doors despite being buried on the grounds. Beneath the hotel lies a network of caves originally used to allow staff to move between areas without being seen by guests, a practice that was once considered essential for maintaining professional standards. Today, these subterranean tunnels are also rumored to be haunted, with visitors occasionally catching the inexplicable scent of baked goods attributed to the ghost of a long-deceased pastry chef. That can haunt me. I'm fine with that.
Actually, yeah. You know what? I'd be pissed off about that because especially if there weren't any pastries, I just smell them and be like, God damn it! I want some pastries and I can't get any right now.
How many times have you asked me to make you something?
I actually try to do it not as often because I know it's a pain for you to do it.
So
you need a homemade do Oreos, so.
So specific rooms in the hotel have their own eerie reputations. Room 401 is often cited as one of the creepiest, reportedly haunted by a hostile male spirit. Some female guests have claimed that they were inappropriately touched by an unseen presence in the room's closet. In room 407, guests have experienced the unsettling sensation of being tucked into bed by an invisible force, and some have felt the weight of someone sitting at the foot of the bed only to discover an indentation on the covers when they turn on the lights. Room 428 is said to be haunted by the apparition of a cowboy who has been standing in the corner or looming over the bed as guests sleep. Despite there being no rooms above 428, guests have frequently reported hearing strange noises like furniture being moved or footsteps from the ceiling. Even without its paranormal fame, the Stanley Hotel is a stunning and fascinating place to visit. However, for those intrigued by the possibility of experiencing a haunting firsthand, it offers a unique opportunity that draws curious visitors from around the world, all hoping to witness something truly profound and unexplainable. The cowboy at the foot of the bed. Like fucking John Wayne.
Well, howdy there, partner. God, that would be creepy.
I'm the Duke. So, the grand staircase between the floors in the Stanley Hotel's lobby, often referred to as the Vortex, is renowned for its eerie and supernatural qualities. This stunning staircase is believed to be a powerful tornado of spiritual energy acting as a paranormal portal for the numerous ghosts that are said to visit the hotel. Guests frequently report experiencing cold spots and sudden dizziness while on the stairs, as if a spirit has passed directly through them. These unsettling feelings are sometimes accompanied by sightings of orbs and visual distortions caught on camera. Mr. and Mrs. Stanley themselves have been seen on occasion appearing hand in hand, watching over the hotel's lively lobby from the grand staircase. Now, the concert hall at the Stanley Hotel, built by F.O. Stanley as a gift for his wife, Flora, is another hotspot of paranormal activity. This elegant venue features a stage with a trapdoor originally designed for dramatic theatrical entrances and exits, and once housed a two-lane bowling alley on its lower level.
I wish that hotel had a bowling alley.
Although the hall underwent extensive repairs and renovations in the 2000s, it remains a favorite haunt of Flora Stanley, who's often heard playing the piano late into the night. Another spirit known to frequent the concert hall is Paul, a former hotel employee who enforced the 11 p.m. curfew in the hotel's early days. Guests and staff have reported hearing Paul's authoritative voice urging them to get out late at night. While a construction worker once felt persistent nudges until he left the area. Paul also seems to enjoy the company of tour groups, as he often flickers their flashlights on request, making his presence known in a subtle yet unmistakable way. Imagine just sitting there, like, drinking, and all you hear is, get out.
I'd be like, bitch, I pay for this room. I'll go when I...
This is the concert hall, not a room.
Oh, I'm just saying, if I'm in a hotel on my vacation and I'm enjoying a drink in the concert hall and some disembodied voice tells me to go, I'm going to tell you, I mean, like, make me.
And it will make you.
Yeah.
It will start choking you.
I would probably leave the fucking room, be like, okay, sorry, and actually get out and respect the ghost.
No, I'll piss the ghost off.
Yeah, I would
pay for my guest experience.
I don't give a flying fuck.
I will be enjoying it, thank you. Unless Paul's going to be giving me a refund.
Paul's going to give you something. The fourth floor of the Stanley Hotel is particularly notorious for its paranormal activity. Guests frequently report hearing the sounds of children running, laughing, and playing in the hallways, despite the absence of any visible children.
I believe when I was looking at that, the fourth floor at one point was like the quarters
where for the family.
Well, the family and the hotel guests, yeah, who had them. So that's why there's children there. And it's, yeah, not necessarily the guests of children. It was the hotel staff's children.
Closet doors on this floor are also known to open and close on their own, adding to the unsettling ambiance. Historically, this floor was originally a vast attic space, which later became lodging for female employees, children, and their nannies. The frequent reports of playful spirits have led some to speculate whether these could be the echoes of past guests or employees, or if they might even be the inspiration behind Stephen King's fictional Grady twins, suggesting that the author's macabre imaginings could be rooted in the hotel's own spectral residence.
I don't know.
The two twin girls.
Hello, Danny.
Really? Stop. Stop.
Nope, I have to do it. Sorry.
No. Creepy.
You kind of do.
No. No, you fucking don't.
We could turn it on the TV.
That's the Grady twins.
I know who they are.
They're still alive today. The actors who played them.
They are right there. It's them today.
I'm good. I know who the Grady twins are.
Red Rum.
That's not the twins, but that's obviously still. But that's still it's a great still a thing. Movie.
Red Rum.
I don't like horror movies. Stop. All right.
Riding the little tricycle.
Come up here and take your medicine.
So before the advent of indoor refrigeration, the Stanley Hotel relied on an outbuilding known as the Ice House to store large blocks of ice, which were essential for keeping food fresh in the early 20th century. Today, the Ice House has been transformed into a museum showcasing some of the original Stanley Steamer's cars, preserving a piece of the hotel's history and its founder's legacy. However, the Ice House is not just home to vintage automobiles. It's also said to be inhabited by at least two spirits. One of these is Billy, a shy child spirit who often appears as a blurry figure in photographs. His presence adds another layer to the intrigue to the small but historically rich building, making a point of interest for visitors fascinated by the hotel's paranormal past. Long before Stephen King's novel Pet Sematary brought the concept of a haunted pet burial ground into popular culture, Stanley Hotel already had its own real-life pet cemetery. Situated just outside the main building, the cemetery is the final resting place for several of the pets that once roamed the grounds, including two beloved animals whose spirits are said to linger. Cassie, a friendly golden retriever, has been known to make her presence felt around the hotel, with guests reporting sightings of a dog that closely resembles her, as well as hearing the sound of scratching at doors. Comanche, a fluffy white cat, is another spectral visitor from the cemetery, often seen or sensed by the guests and staff alike. Both Cassie and Comanche add a touch of nostalgia and gentle eeriness to the hotel's already impressive collection of ghostly tales, further enhancing the Stanley's hotel reputation as a place where the past and paranormal intertwine.
Funny enough, in Pet Sematary, one of the featured animals that's brought back is a cat. Not named Comanche, but it is a cat. So
yeah.
Tell me again, I guarantee you he got inspiration for that too here.
The area, in wrapping up the Stanley Hotel, the area in front of the Stanley Hotel, originally a long driveway for the iconic Stanley Steamer automobiles and a promenade for guests to take in the stunning mountain views, underwent a significant transformation in 2015 with the introduction of a hedge maze. This addition was inspired by the hedge maze featured in Stanley Kubrick's film adaptation of Stephen King's The Shining, the suspenseful and iconic element of the movie that was not present in King's original novel. In King's version, the lawn of the fictional Overlook Hotel was adorned with topiary animals that added a menacing presence. To bring this connection to life, the Stanley Hotel held a global competition, receiving 300 design entries from around the world, ultimately selecting a design that would link the hotel even more closely to its horror film legacy. Although no specific ghosts or spirits have been reported within the maze, visitors often experience feelings of anxiety and disorientation, and some have reported difficulty breathing while navigating through twisting paths. These sensations, whether due to the psychological influence of The Shining or the inherent challenge of the maze, contribute to the maze's eerie reputation and further enhance the Stanley Hotel's appeal as a destination where the line between fiction and reality is intriguingly blurred.
I've never been in a hedge maze before.
You'd probably get lost.
I would probably get lost.
100% get lost.
As opposed to you two, you guys, you wouldn't get lost?
I've been in one before.
I wouldn't get myself in one.
Okay, so. From the chilly mountain air of Colorado, Let's trade in our snow boots for sea legs as we board one of the most famous ocean liners in history. But don't be fooled by the elegance of the RMS Queen Mary. This lady of the sea has some spine-tingling tales of her own. Hope you don't mind sharing your cabin with a few ghostly passengers who might still be setting sail for the beyond. Let's talk about the RMS Queen Mary. So, the RMS Queen Mary is a legendary British ocean liner that has captivated the world with a rich history and enduring legacy. Launched in 1934 and renowned for her opulent interiors and impressive speed, she served as one of the premier transatlantic vessels of her time. During her illustrious career, she carried celebrities, dignitaries, and thousands of passengers across the Atlantic. However, her story extends far beyond luxury and glamour. The Queen Mary also has a darker side, marked by tragic accidents, wartime service, and a reputation for being one of the most haunted ships in the world. Today, she stands as a floating hotel and museum in Long Beach, California, drawing visitors from around the globe eager to explore her historic decks and perhaps encounter one of the many spirits said to roam her corridors. I love that it's a British ocean liner and we stole it and turned it into a museum.
Yeah.
To remain competitive in the shipbuilding race against Weimar Germany, which had recently launched the Bremen and Europa, the United Kingdom and its maritime companies embarked on an ambitious project of their own. The White Star Line, a principal competitor of Cunard, initiated the construction of the 80,000-ton Oceanic in 1928. Concurrently, Cunard laid out plans for an unnamed 75,000-ton liner.
Just to let you all know, White Star was the same people who built the Titanic.
Yes.
No wonder it had so many issues.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Work began on the vessel, initially referred to as Hull Number 534, in December 1930 at the John Brown and Company shipyard on the River Clyde in Clydebank, Scotland. However, the Great Depression brought construction to a standstill by December 1931. Seeking financial assistance, Cunard applied for a loan from the British government, which agreed to provide the funds necessary to complete the project. The loan's conditions include the completion of the unfinished ship and the construction of a sister ship to establish a two-ship weekly service to New York. A stipulation of the loan required Cunard to merge with its rival, the White Star Line, which had been similarly affected by the economic downturn and had halted the construction of its own Oceanic.
Plus, you know, two of its liners sinking. Yeah, sure, that didn't really.
We don't talk about that.
Yeah. No. Is it like Bruno? We just don't talk about the Titanic?
We don't talk about Titanic.
Oh.
The merger was finalized on 10 May 1934, forming the Cunard White Star Line to oversee the newly consolidated fleet. With its financial backing secured, work on Hull 534 resumed promptly, and the ship was launched on September 26, 1934. The construction spanned 3.5 years and cost £3.5 million, equivalent to approximately $310 million in 2023. The ship's design was primarily the work of Cunard's chief naval architect, George McLeod Patterson. The vessel, christened Queen Mary, was outfitted with 24 Yarra boilers distributed across four boiler rooms and powered by four Parsons turbines housed in two engine rooms. These boilers generated steam at a pressure of 400 pounds per square inch and a temperature of 700 degrees Fahrenheit, producing up to 212,000 shaft horsepower and driving four propellers at 200 revolutions a minute.
That's
like, fuck.
This is a very powerful engine. It's fast because it's so big. If its weight was lighter, it would be a very fast ship. But this is massive. 212,000 shaft horsepower is a lot. But it's also an 80,000-pound ship. So,
actually, from what I heard is we're going to see there's actually once he was able to strip her down a little bit, especially during her service in the war, this thing had that those powerful engines helped get her, had a lot of giddy up power.
The ship's name was kept secret until her launch. Cunard originally intended to name her Victoria, following its tradition of using names ending in IA. However, upon seeking King George V's approval for the name, company representatives mentioned their desire to name the ship after Britain's greatest queen. The king, misunderstanding the intention, suggested that his wife, Queen Mary, would be honored. With no alternative but to comply, the ship was officially named Queen Mary. To avoid confusion with existing Clyde turbine steamer TS Queen Mary, an arrangement was made to rename the older vessel Queen Mary II. Like, we want to name it after the greatest queen. Oh, yes, my wife.
Sure.
Yes, yes, sir.
That's almost exactly how it was. Yeah. Like, literally, they...
Yeah, went, yeah, oh, yeah, it was Queen
like,
Mary.
He was like, wonderful, my wife will be so thrilled. And it's like...
Wrong queen.
He's like, we're talking about Victoria.
We're talking about a queen that actually did something. Mm-hmm. On September 26, 1934, Queen Mary herself launched the ship. Now that's cool.
That is cool.
As RMS Queen Mary slid down the slipway, 18 drag chains were used to control her descent into the River Clyde, which had been specially widened and deepened to accommodate her massive size. That's what he said.
How embarrassing would that have been if they hadn't done that?
Just grinding the whole way.
Oh, shit.
We're dry docked.
But it's in the... Yeah, they would have basically got stuck in the mud. It's like, yeah, we did it. It's now a... hotel.
This is as useful as Queen Mary. God. Following the launch, the ship underwent an extensive fitting out, culminating in her departure from Clydebank for sea trials in March 1936. During these trials, she demonstrated her impressive capabilities, reaching a top speed of 32.84 knots.
Like I said, this thing, that's fast.
Insanely fast. And so keep in mind that this departed in 1936. What's about to happen?
World War II.
Mustache Man's extravaganza.
That's one way to put it, I mean.
So, this thing, for a ship that's fast, I mean, this thing was doing, so, a top speed of 32.84 knots, that is 37 miles an hour, 38 miles an hour. So, for a ship this big, that's fast.
Oh, yeah.
This is a massive ship.
And that
I'm getting used to my knots conversion that I'm going to need.
But and also, Ken, this is when it is a luxury liner, where it is meant to...
It's not supposed to be fast.
Yes, exactly. But and also, we're going to see how fast you'll get in a few years, actually.
So, in late August 1939, the RMS Queen Mary embarked on a final peacetime voyage from New York to Southampton, escorted by the battlecruiser HMS Hood.
Ooh.
Due to the increasingly tense international situation.
Fun fact, everybody, the Hood was one shot, one killed by the German battleship Bismarck in World War II.
Yeah.
Out of the 1,100 guys who were on that ship, only three made it.
Arriving safely in the UK, she set sail once more for New York on September 1st. However, by the time she reached the United States, war had been declared, and she, along with the French liner Normandy... Fitting.
Normandy
was ordered to remain in port. In March 1940, the Queen Mary was joined by her new running mates, the Queen Elizabeth, so the better queen, marking a historic moment as the three largest liners in the world were docked together in New York.
And they would be, all three ships would be seized and used for the war effort.
That it's like literally water tanks. Is basically why they wanted these, because they were so fucking massive.
Especially when the U.S. got involved, these ships, again, once you strip all of them of their luxurious things and just basically turn them to a troop transport, I think they said at one point they got like 10,000 guys in one trip.
15,000.
15,000.
In a single voyage, which we're about to talk about. Well, Normandy was tragically destroyed by fire during her conversion into a troop ship. Leave it to the French to destroy their own ship while
in the wrong harbor. It's like, oh, those damn Germans will never get us. It's like, you're in New York, asshole.
Oh, shit. The Queen Mary and Queen Elizabeth were soon requisitioned for military service. Queen Mary left New York for Sydney, Australia in March 1940 to undergo conversion into a troop ship, earning the nickname Grey Ghost due to her wartime grey paint and remarkable speed. Stripped of her luxurious interior, she was refitted with triple-tiered bunks to accommodate thousands of soldiers. The vessel's agility and high speed combined with a degaussing coil to protect against magnetic mines made her a formidable asset. So what happened during World War II is the German U-boats would drop these magnetic mines so that when ships would go over, the mines would attach to the hull and then explode. Well, what they did is they put coils on the bottom of the ship that's basically another magnet. So yeah. It was repelling these the entire time. So they would start to come up and then it would go and repel it down and they'd just be able to cruise right through the fucking mines.
That's like
it
was how HMS Ark Royal was sunk in Scapa Flow in World War II. The German U-boat snuck in. Scapa Flow is like one of two of the main, even today, there are two main naval bases and it's in Scotland. And German U-boat was able to slip through because some dumbass didn't put the U-boat nets up across the harbor. That guy got fired. And the U-boat laid a bunch of mines, and so the battleship Ark Royal is just like, oh, we're safe, doo-doo-doo-doo-doo. Boom! Goes down.
So the... Sorry. She, along with Queen Elizabeth, became the largest and fastest troop ships in the war, often transporting up to 15,000 men in a single voyage.
Everyone wonders how we got all those troops into England to build up for Normandy.
This is how. Their impressive speed allowed them to travel without escort, evading German U-boats, despite a notable encounter in May 1944 when U-853 attempted to attack the Queen Mary but was outrun. Outrun a U-boat.
God!
This is how fast they are.
The U-boat commander tried to later, I want to say either he survived or however, he tried to say, like, I came at the wrong angle. I would have caught him up to him. I'm like,
okay,
sure, yeah, sure you could.
So such was the importance of these ships that Adolf Hitler himself offered a substantial bounty to any U-boat captain who could sink either vessel, underscoring their critical role in the Allied war effort. And guess what happened? Didn't happen.
Nope.
Those people didn't get their money.
No. Considering by the time Hitler really got serious with that, he really didn't have very many U-boat captains left to kind of carry out the task. But I mean, again, these two ships were very vital. Crucial. I mean, 15,000 men, that's a division.
Yeah.
That is one division going across. That's like today we would never do that. We split it up amongst different boats.
Because we're smarter now. Because they take out one boat, that's 15,000 men you just lost. Yeah. That's why we don't do that.
We've learned. Yeah, I mean, if they had taken out that, I mean...
We may have lost the war. Who knows?
If I remember correctly, that incident, the U-853 incident, when they caught them, the Queen Mary was actually transporting the 29th Infantry Division across it. That was the...
Like, the 29th Infantry. Like
the ones who first wave of Omaha Beach.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean...
You're the only one that knows World War II.
If that U-boat would have hit, we would not have been able to take Omaha Beach.
Yeah.
That's it.
Or at least another division. We would have had to wait to get another division.
Yeah.
And the weather probably would have changed because the English Channel is so...
unpredictable.
Yeah.
We'll end up doing, maybe next year on the anniversary of D-Day, we'll do a whole thing on D-Day and... Normandy and all of that kind of stuff.
Don't threaten me with a good time.
We'll probably do an episode on that on the anniversary of D-Day. In December 1942, the RMS Queen Mary embarked on a remarkable voyage carrying 10,389 soldiers and 950 crew members, a total of 11,339 people across the Atlantic. During this journey, on December 11th, while navigating through a violent gale approximately 700 miles from the Scottish coast, she was struck by a massive rogue wave estimated to be around 28 meters for us that use Freedom, 92 feet high.
Holy fuck.
Yeah. The force of the wave hit her starboard side, causing the ship to roll perilously to an angle of 52 degrees. So that means she is upended.
Like this.
Yeah. almost backflipping. According to accounts, including those by Dr. Norval Carter, who was aboard with 110th Station Hospital, ship nearly capsized. Had she rolled just 3 degrees more, the Queen Mary might have met a disastrous fate. So, and literally what happened is this 92-foot high wave hits. It hits the starboard side, flips it ass end up. It almost tips over, and then the wave subsides, and they were literally able to get the weight back to the front of the ship to make it splash back down. And then they just kept fucking trucking.
I mean, you can imagine just some sergeant's like,
get to the front, get to the front! And everybody's like climbing to get to the top. Now Titanic again!
I bet you...
That wasn't an iceberg!
I bet you there was some fun, because the crews of these were British.
Yeah.
So you can imagine there was probably some middle-aged British guys like, ah, fuck, not again! Molly
Brown. I'm not trying to be Molly Brown. I visited her house.
Oh, really?
The following year, from 25 to 30 July 1943, she set a record by transporting 15,740 soldiers and 943 crew members, a staggering total of 16,683 people, the highest number ever carried on a single vessel. This achievement was only possible during the summer months, as many passengers were forced to sleep on the open decks due to overcrowding. The Queen Mary also served as a vital asset for high-profile missions, carrying British Prime Minister Winston Churchill across the Atlantic on 3 occasions. Churchill listed under the pseudonym Colonel Worden on passenger manifest, used the liner as a mobile headquarters. On one significant crossing in 1943, he and his staff meticulously planned the Normandy invasion and signed the D-Day Declaration aboard the ship. Churchill later praised the contributions of the Queen Mary and her sister ship, Queen Elizabeth, stating that their efforts challenged the fury of Hitlerism in the Battle of the Atlantic.
Challenge the fury of Hitler in the Battle of the Atlantic.
That's exactly what I just did.
I did it better.
No, you did.
Sorry. Kate did it.
And played an essential role in ensuring the timely victory of the Allied forces.
Honestly, it kind of did. I mean, again, basically a division each crossing.
Yeah. By the end of World War II, Queen Mary had transported over 800,000 troops and traveled more than 600,000 miles across the globe, solidifying her legacy as one of the most significant troop ships in history. On October 2nd, 1942, a tragic incident occurred when the RMS Queen Mary accidentally collided with and sank her escort ship, the light cruiser HMS Curacoa, off the coast of Ireland. The Queen Mary, carrying thousands of American troops from the 29th Infantry Division to reinforce Allied forces in Europe, sliced through the Curacoa, resulting in loss of 338 lives from a crew of 437. Due to strict wartime orders to avoid stopping under any circumstances to reduce the risk of U-boat attacks, Queen Mary continued on her course despite sustaining damage to her bow. Reports regarding the aftermath of the collision vary. Some sources state that hours later, the convoy's lead escorts, including HMS Bramham, returned to rescue 99 survivors, including Curacoa's captain, John W. Boutwood. However, according to Harry Gradage, the staff captain of the Queen Mary, Captain Gordon Illingsworth immediately ordered the destroyers accompanying the liner search for survivors shortly after the collision. This incident remains one of the most tragic episodes of the Queen Mary's wartime service, highlighting the harsh realities and difficult decisions faced during the height of World War II.
Now, I dug a little deeper into what caused this. Essentially, nobody was talking to one another. There was the Queen Mary was zigzagging, and obviously when they did their board review, the Royal Navy blamed the Queen Mary blamed the Royal Navy. Everyone just kind of tossed it up to like, hey, you know, talk, you know, nobody planned how they were going to do that. Usually when they do these plot navigations, they do it ahead of time. The convoy commander has a copy. He knows what everyone's going to do. They're supposed to call in if there's ever an adjustment to it. Apparently, it just didn't happen. Either the Curacoa was
wasn't where it's supposed to be,
or the Queen Mary wasn't supposed to be. That's
and they also they tended to try and maintain radio silence during these to not get intercepted.
Exactly. So
and they did zigzag because I mean U-boats fired in a straight line.
Yeah.
So if they can zigzag, they're gonna miss that U-boat.
Exactly. So no one really knows, and it's just a tragedy. And like they said, unfortunately, you can't stop because
it's too vulnerable.
Yeah, exactly. So this
take out the small ship than the big one.
Yeah. The now this next incident, I forgot to put in here, but this actually happened in 1960. This was not a World War II incident.
Among the ship's many tragedies, one of the most well-known involves a young crew member named John Petter, who was tragically crushed by a watertight door during an emergency drill. Another crew member lost his life after accidentally consuming gin that had been tainted with cleaning fluid.
That was just stupid.
While these incidents stand out due to their tragic and unusual nature, most of the other reported deaths aboard the Queen Mary were attributed to natural causes. Despite these unfortunate events, they've contributed to the ship's reputation as one of the most haunted places in the world, with numerous accounts of paranormal activity linked to these untimely deaths.
So with John Petter, the way it sounds, with the interviews that I did watch, it sounded like there was a drill that they were running, and he decided, hey, I'm young and stupid. I'm going to try to do this door by myself. It's a two-person door.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, he didn't get out of the way in time, and he did get crushed. It was across like one shoulder all the way down to essentially his hip.
Yeah.
So
it didn't cut him in half. I believe they said it was just crushed him and
crushed him in half essentially.
Yeah. And they had to, unfortunately, they were out at sea when this happened, so they had to put him in cold storage.
They had to clear out the fruit and vegetable fridge and put him in there.
Yeah. Happens.
Yep.
I mean, it's actually standard on
cruise ships,
Navy ships.
Yep.
They clear out the ice cream and put them in. But the whole crew gets ice cream.
Yeah.
Because they don't want it to melt.
What happened? Oh, where's Pete? That's so
ice cream party.
So sad. That's chocolate syrup.
Yeah. So the RMS Queen Mary is renowned not only for her storied past, but also for the multitude of ghostly tales and eerie encounters reported aboard. Allegedly haunted by over 100 spirits, the most infamous of these hauntings centers around stateroom B340, where paranormal activity has been so intense that many crew members avoid the room entirely. Origins of the haunting are murky, with various stories attempting to explain the sinister presence. In 1948, a third-class passenger named Walter J. Adamson mysteriously died in this room. Some speculate that his restless spirit haunts the space, while others wonder if it was an entity already present that claimed his life. Another chilling account suggests that in the 1960s, a man was locked in his third-class cabin after brutally murdering two women. He spent the night frantically pounding on the door, screaming that something was in the room with him. By morning, he was found dead, his body horrifically mutilated as though he had been torn apart. When the Queen Mary was retired and converted into a hotel in 1967, several third-class cabins were merged to create what is now known as Stateroom B340. Almost immediately, guests began reporting unsettling experiences. One woman recounted waking up to find her bed covers violently pulled off, and a shadowy figure standing at the foot of her bed. Other guests have reported hearing disembodied voices, seeing flickering lights, and finding faucets inexplicably turning on by themselves. The situation grew so dire that the room was closed to the public throughout the 1970s due to the overwhelming number of complaints and unsettling occurrences. It remained sealed off for over 30 years, only reopening in 2018 as a haunted attraction. Even today, the room comes with a stern warning to those brave enough to spend the night. The current captain of the ship has reportedly refused to enter the room, adding to its dark mystique. Other haunted areas aboard the Queen Mary include the former first-class swimming pool where spectral swimmers have been seen, boiler room number 4, a hotspot for ghost sightings, and the doorway where John Petter tragically lost his life during an emergency drill. His spirit, often described as wearing blue coveralls, is said to appear to visitors, sometimes running behind them or asking if they've seen his wrench, only to vanish moments later.
So surprisingly, in the interview that I did watch, nothing actually happened in the first-class swimming pool. There was no drownings. nothing. Nobody can explain why that area is haunted.
No.
Ghosts want to swim, man. Let them swim.
Yeah.
The ship's reputation as the most haunted ship in the world draws numerous paranormal enthusiasts eager to explore the dark side of the historic liner. But even beyond the ghost stories, there's an undeniable eeriness that permeates the Queen Mary. Spider grandeur and glamour, the vessel is a haunting reminder of a bygone era, forever marked by the tragedies and untold stories of those who sailed aboard her. By the 1960s, the age of luxurious ocean liners had faded as air travel became the preferred mode of transatlantic transportation. The once thriving industry dwindled, and the Queen Mary, despite her opulence, could not compete with the modern cruise ships that had begun to dominate the market. Ultimately, Cunard made the difficult decision to sell the ship to the city of Long Beach, where she was transformed into a floating hotel and museum. Today, with much of her original 1930s charm intact, the Queen Mary still impresses visitors with elegant interiors, crafted from an astonishing array of mixed woods, earning her the nickname the Ship of Woods. Stepping aboard, one can almost feel the echoes of her past grandeur and the excitement that once filled her decks. However, beneath the polished veneer lies a vessel haunted not only by its physical ghost, but also by the weight of its tumultuous history. Though time and renovations have polished her exterior, they have done little to bury the dark secrets that linger in the shadows of the RMS Queen Mary. It is renowned not only for a storied past, but also for the multitude of ghostly tales and encounters reported aboard. Allegedly haunted by over 100 spirits, the most infamous of these hauntings centers again around stateroom B340, where it's been so intense that they avoid the room entirely. So let's see here. Ben repeated stuff.
Yeah.
Yes, you did.
That whole
thing is all repeated.
Yeah, the last two pages are repeated.
But yeah, so that is the RMS Queen Mary.
So there has been no reported murders on the ship. The only deaths associated is what happened in World War II, mm-hmm. but it wasn't a death on the Queen Mary. And then the death of John Petter was right. The only like confirmed death of the RMS Queen Mary.
Yeah. But yeah.
I'd love to see this place, if nothing more, just because I'm a fan.
I'd like to go stay there.
Nope.
I'd go stay there.
Yeah, you guys can have the haunted stateroom. I will be on land. I'd stay in it. I would be on land in a hotel on the land.
This is a hotel.
Yeah.
On land, not in the water.
I mean, technically, it's tied up to a dock, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm not.
It would be funny if Pam did that. She goes to a hotel. It's like, say, right across the street, and it's also haunted.
It's more haunted than the Queen Mary.
That would just be my fucking luck.
I mean, honestly, researching this and looking at all of the stories of both the Stanley and the RMS Queen Mary, really, most of the hauntings seem to be mostly. Like residual, if they call it residual hauntings, like we're just kind of getting glimpses of.
Yeah, so I think a lot of like the Queen Mary, a lot of it is residual, except for John Petter.
Yeah. But
Stanley Hotel. I don't know.
There's nothing. I think what we should to let everyone know. There's nothing sinister about these places.
No.
Tragic in some cases, yes, especially with the Queen Mary, but very benign. Like nobody wants to have a haunting or ghost encounter. In my opinion, as much as I'm fascinated by the paranormal, I think I'd probably be petrified if an actual ghost came up and touched me. But I mean. There are worse places you could go to have a ghost encounter. It's not like, you know, there's demons or anything else in these places.
Yeah. So the next one, we're going to kind of do a mix of stuff. We'll be doing tulpas. We'll be doing some Reddit threads of hauntings and stuff. And we'll kind of see if we believe that they're true and all of that. So to kind of wrap up the Halloween month, and then to then we're going to go right into what will end up being our season finale, which is the 4-part on the Zodiac Killer. And that is how we're going to wrap up the season. And then just a reminder that season 3 will be mostly a re-record of season 1 so we can get you guys some better quality stuff and maybe get it out there for those of you that didn't see or hear season 1. We'll kind of re-record most of that stuff. And then
I may not be in a lot of those because they did more graphic ones.
Yeah. So, but yeah, so that was RMS Queen Mary and Stanley Hotel. We want to thank you for visiting the Scarlet Tavern. Remember to turn in your glasses, push in your seat, and as always, tip the bard. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.